This is Bob Benyart inviting you to read our manuscript, The Plot, for an overview of the whole Bible. Call us at 800-836-9278. That's 836-9278. Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Benyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. You're listening to the 50,000-watt AM 670 KLTT, the most powerful Christian radio station in America. Well, today's program will be different than most. Whether we have a guest or callers, we normally dive right into debates on abortion, evolution, the death penalty, and such. But today, I'm going to tell you about a book on black colleges. This book may be the first ever published history of black colleges and universities, co-authored by Juan Williams. He's the senior NPR correspondent and Fox News analyst, you know, one of Brit Hume's all-stars. If you're an American history buff or have attended any of the more than 100 black colleges in America, you'll definitely find this gift book fascinating and rich in history and photographs. The book is titled I'll Find a Way or Make One. That is a great title. I'll Find a Way or Make One, a tribute to historically black colleges and universities. Juan Williams, when did the first black colleges emerge in America's history?
Well, you got to go back to the 1830s, 1837, I believe it is, Bob, and Cheney State in Pennsylvania is the first black college in America, and it really didn't start there. It really was an effort of people up in New England to try to educate some free blacks in their community. That was rejected. It caused political problems. Eventually, it gets moved to Pennsylvania, and that's how Cheney gets started, with support from many church groups, in fact. And then what you see is after the Civil War, that's when you get a real rush with the end of slavery. So many in the church community, you know, you just can't overstate it. Every denomination went down south with the idea that they were going to use the good book, our Bible, as the basis, the basic text for educating free black people, creating the schools that would allow people to become literate, to become educated in terms of how to use mathematics so that they could be self-sufficient. And, of course, for slaves, that was the be-all and end-all. Literally, they had been legally denied the opportunity to get an education. It was illegal to teach slaves how to read and write.
And that's what I'm hoping we can get through here, understand the history of blacks in America from the perspective of their education. Juan Williams, thanks for joining me on Bob Benyart Live. So when you said that the churches were involved, so the movement to educate newly freed slaves was powered, that movement was powered by blacks and also white abolitionists and white Christians, that's true?
Absolutely. White Christians. Now, let me just say to you that obviously there was an evangelical aspect. They wanted
to
convert free slaves to join their denomination. So
right.
You had competition among everybody, Presbyterians, Lutherans, Baptists, everybody, to try to reach out because they saw that there was a population of people here who were going to find a home in some church community, and they wanted it to be theirs. Now, of course, there's all sorts of interesting dynamics given our country's very troubled history of race relations. I mean, eventually some of these churches will break off and become their own separate black
right.
versions of that church. And, of course, there's all sorts of arguments about who supplies everything from the Sunday bulletin to the Bibles and hymnals that are used in those churches and control of the churches. But my point, and the big point, I think, for us to understand, Bob, is that when it came to providing the money, the time, the talent, the teachers who went down south and got these institutions going, overwhelmingly, it was the white Christian community.
And Juan, being a Caucasian myself, although I don't know if any of my ancestors scaled the Caucasus Mountains, but I deeply regret America's criminal mistreatment of blacks, of course. It was horrendous. And therefore, when I look back in history and even today, I especially appreciate whites who have worked in history, worked the Underground Railroad and to bring literacy to the black community in America. And those today who are helping blacks achieve spiritual and economic success. So for me, it's a double-edged sword. The tragedy of America's role in slavery, this criminal type of racist-based slavery, but then the love and concern by some who saw the injustice of it all and tried to repair the damage.
Well, it's an incredible story. I mean, in a story, you know, I've written a book about the black religious experience, and it's called This Far by Faith. And one of the things that just astounds me, Bob, is, you know, you stop and you think about slaves coming to this country without any experience with Christianity. They had a great deal of faith, but came from different religious traditions on the continent of Africa. They are stripped of those religious traditions by the slave traders. Families broken apart, people lose their names, sense of identity. You know, obviously they lose their connection to place. But they come to this country, and initially Christianity is used to say to those slaves that your reward is in heaven. God wants you to be good slaves, and if you're good slaves and obedient and subservient, then you will have your reward. And it's the slaves coming to terms with Christianity that they come to see Christ as a liberation figure, a man who will liberate, who speaks for those who have been marginalized, left behind, despised. And they come to identify with Christ, and they then become devout Christians and begin to see Christianity as their salvation and put pressure on the white church in terms of insisting that they be included and seen as fellow Christians. But it's interesting, as I said to you earlier, even to read the Bible, it was illegal to teach a slave how to read the Bible, because obviously then the slave could go on and read other things and he would no longer be, or she would no longer be, such cheap labor. It would undermine the slave economy. And so you had all sorts of contradictions built in, but eventually what happens is the white Christian community sees that slave population as it becomes freed after the Civil War in 1865, becomes free. They then see them as fellow Christians and look to educate and help them. And that is just, it may be the greatest philanthropic outpouring that we've seen in American history.
So that when today, to make a parallel, tragically, we could make the parallel of Islamic extremists who refused to allow women to be educated. And that was the Christian position of the slaveholders toward an entire race of people, toward blacks.
Yes, and with, you know, you have to, again, in some ways, when I was listening to you, Bob, I thought, well, you know, Bob's right, but I don't want him to think that it was all about malice. In some sense, it was just business. You know how sometimes you have conversations with people and they say, don't get your emotions involved, it's just business. Well, the idea that a slave could read and write literally meant that the slave could escape, because they could write themselves a pass that would say that they were entitled to travel freely and that it could then flee to the north. And, of course, if a person could read and write and could handle basic business transactions in terms of the math and the money, they could do better than being a slave. So it was essential for the slave masters, and that's what they did, deny people, made it illegal in the southern states to teach people the basics, which meant that once the population of slaves was freed, they were thirsting, not only because of the sense that, you know, the desire for intellectual stimulation to read and to learn the knowledge, for knowledge, but it was a matter of survival, that their ability to hold a job, to be valuable in terms of the American economy, relied on their ability to gain an education, and that's where the Christian community came in.
Juan Williams, your book, I'll Find a Way or Make One, a tribute to historically black colleges and universities. You go back to the 1600s, 1700s, and what was the education like of blacks who were brought to America from Africa? Was there any literacy? What was it like back then?
Well, you have to remember, of course, they're coming into British colonies. But for the most part, these were, in some cases, people who were educated. These are people who were stolen from tribes, some who had education. You know, there's often talk about Timbuktu and the great kind of intellectual variety that existed there and elsewhere in the continent of Africa. So in some cases, people did have education. In other cases, these were people who were prisoners of war between tribes in Africa and brought to these shores. Once they reached these shores, in some cases, the free slaves, especially in the north, were insisting on educational opportunities. And at in some cases, especially in the early part of our nation's history, that were allowed to join in educational opportunities, to join into schools. But that door pretty soon closed as there became more and more of a stigma attached to blacks because of the presence of slavery in the society. And that's why, for example, we were talking earlier about Cheney State in Pennsylvania. That's why when there is this tremendous movement afoot to establish a college for blacks, that eventually gets pushed out of New England and settles into Pennsylvania.
So when there was a somewhat basically a failed effort to provide higher education for blacks in the Northeast until after the Civil War, when black colleges, the movement exploded. But how about at that time around the world, were there black colleges or universities elsewhere? Or was America the place where this first hit human history?
Oh, no, obviously there were institutions of higher learning in Africa. The question, though, is a tricky one, Bob, because it may not be identified in specific as a college. But, for example, Arab nations, you go back.
Oh, right. In Alexandria in Egypt.
Yes, and I was going to even extend that. I mean, if you think about Socratic dialogues and Plato, I mean, that's where they are. So, yeah.
But, okay. All right. And how about at the time, then, if you come into modern history in the 1800s after the Civil War, were there black colleges elsewhere in the world at that time?
I don't know the specific answer to that. That's, you got me there.
All right.
But what I do know is that you had in some of these African countries institutions of higher learning. Again, I don't know if they were labeled as colleges, but you had educational systems in place in some of the more advanced societies in Africa.
Okay. And how about this? The black colleges appeared after the Civil War. When did the black middle class first appear? And those two had to be somewhat related.
You're exactly right. In fact, you can chart so much of the growth and progress of blacks in America with regard to the success and the development of alumni coming out of these black institutions. I mean, for example, the Harlem Renaissance would not have happened without America's historically black colleges and universities. But if you're talking in general about a black middle class, I would advise you to think of someone like a W.E.B. Du Bois, the famous sociologist, orator, NAACP leader. He's a graduate of Fisk University in Tennessee, a historically black college, and he goes on to Harvard to get his Ph.D. This is another example. He was sort of the quintessence, if you will, of an educated black middle class, and that comes at the end of the 1800s. And what you see is, really, if you stop and think about, I would say, not only the Harlem Renaissance, but going into the 1940s, almost exclusively, the black middle class is a function either of people getting opportunities in northern factories, places like Ford Motor, which hired blacks early as they were taking part in the Great Migration from the South, or people who were graduates of these historically black colleges and universities, because, remember, majority white schools were not admitting blacks. In fact, they, in general, weren't admitting women. So there was quite an exclusionary policy. And then after the 1950s, 1960s, again, you see an explosion in terms of that black middle class. And why? Because graduation rates from colleges, now including the majority colleges, expands. And so I believe it is from something like 1966 up to the start of this century, the 21st century, you see an increase in black graduation rates that goes from about 6% to 14%, and that's the basis for the black middle class as we know it today.
Your book is titled I'll Find a Way or Make One, A Tribute to Historically Black Colleges and Universities. You use the phrase, which is commonly used, historically black colleges. Why not just black colleges and universities? Why always historically black colleges?
Because, the history is part of the tradition. It's not just that it's a black college. We could talk about, Brigham Young and say it's a Mormon school. We could talk about Brandeis and say it's a Jewish school. We could talk about Notre Dame, say it's a Catholic Jesuit school, Georgetown. But what's different here is that there's a history behind these schools. And it's American history, Bob. that makes them so special. American history that was all about denying people an education then comes to the point where it creates, at the end of slavery, these institutions. So it's an outgrowth of the tensions, the dynamics of American history. In fact, the federal government, the U.S. government, was part of this. Howard University in Washington, D.C., literally was founded, its name for General Oliver Howard, one of the Civil War military heroes, but a man who was put in charge of the Freedmen's Bureau, which was to take care of free black people. And so Howard University is established under federal government auspices in Washington, D.C.
And the most famous alumnus of Howard University, who would that be?
I would think that if you're talking about the entire university, it would be Thurgood Marshall, who graduated from their law school and, of course, went on to become the chief counsel for the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, and then was the lawyer who won the Brown decision, the decision that broke apart legal segregation in the country in 1954. But goodness gracious, they have a roster of prominent alumni, you know, everybody from actors and actresses to, and even on their faculty, you had people like Elaine Locke, Ralph Bunche, who went on to win a Nobel Prize as a UN U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. There's no shortage. Toni Morrison taught there. It's hard to stop. But where to start and where to stop, I don't know, Bob.
And we're talking to Juan Williams, co-author of I'll Find a Way or Make One, a tribute to historically black colleges and universities. Juan, how about today? There have been 107 such colleges. What is the racial makeup on their campuses today? Is there a trend one way or another to stay all black, to admit other minorities, whites?
Well, I was going to say the big trend is the admission of whites, because so many of these schools get state dollars, and so there has been pressure on them to integrate. And this comes, you know, we normally think of integration as blacks going into a mostly white environment. Here's integration from the other direction. So you have schools, I think a particular of a school in West Virginia, Bluefield State, that is now mostly white, but it's a historically black college and university. Or you think even of West Virginia State, which was, again, historically black, and now it's just about 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you see is at the historically black colleges throughout the country, the presence of whites and Hispanics in numbers that, you know, previously there was even some stigma attached. You know, why would a white person go to this school? It was thought to have been an inferior school,
mm-hmm.
questions about accreditation and the like. Now I think people are seeing them as another avenue for gaining an education.
Now, what I'd like to do, Juan, is talk a little bit, for me, this is where the fun part begins, really, a little bit about my criticism of black colleges. And I'd like to get your response to this. And first, to set it up, my audience knows me, but obviously you don't. My wife, Cheryl, by the way, said to say hi. We watch you on Brett Humes all the time.
Oh, thanks for watching.
Yeah, it's fun. And we're conservative Christians. But just to let you know, I grew up, I'm 46. My dad was basically a racist. He was an agnostic racist, and he hated everybody. I shouldn't say that with a little chuckle, but in his life, later in his life, he changed. My mom was a Christian who loved everybody, and she's the one who had the big influence on the kids. My father hated blacks, Puerto Ricans, even hated Italians, and he married. My mom's 100% Italian. So he became Christian late, maybe just a few years before he died, and he really had a huge change. But anyway, so that's how I grew up, and I've become a conservative Christian fundamentalist pastor talk show host, and I, on occasion, when the topic comes up, have criticism for the black community, just like I do the white community, and black colleges like white colleges. But I guess you could sum up my criticism with a verse out of the Bible, Proverbs 16, verse 8, which says, better is a little with righteousness than vast revenues without it. What I see is that, yeah, we're educating blacks and whites, and we're helping them to become more prosperous, and those things are good, except that I see that the moral foundation of human existence has been kicked out from under us and under each new generation of students. And they're floundering while their income is going up. The, you know, three quarters of babies born to unmarried women, the incredible moral breakdown in the popular culture, women treat it like filth in the gutter, millions of black babies killed out of proportion to whites by Planned Parenthood and other abortionists. And so I see that the black colleges have done virtually nothing to stem the tide. In fact, they even advocate things that I see as fundamentally destructive of successful human lives.
Well, like what?
Well, like if you take the Ten Commandments, I think black colleges have failed blacks when it comes to thou shalt not covet, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal. These are absolutes in the conservative Christian worldview. And in the liberal worldview, which black colleges have embraced, thou shalt not covet is replaced by class envy. And thou shalt not steal is replaced by transfer of money from my neighbor to me and all kinds of benefits. And thou shalt not commit adultery is replaced by marriage is not necessary for sexual relations.
Boy, well, I got to tell you something.
Yeah.
I mean, I agree with you on a few of these, but on several, I find myself in disagreement, Bob.
All right, go ahead.
I think that, for example, when you said this business about there's no need for marriage, I think that is a terrifically defeating trend going on in the black community. It leads to dysfunctional families, and I think it has a terrible toll, takes a terrible toll on America's black children. And so I couldn't agree with you more about that. I don't know that that is promoted by the colleges, though. I would say that I see that throughout black American culture.
The culture. Juan, I spent 6 months in jail in the past, 10, 15 years as a pro-life, nonviolent activist,
right,
kneeling and praying in front of abortion mills. And I spent 2 months of that with felons in Denver County Jail, which is disproportionately black. And it was so utterly discouraging to hear the demeaning way that blacks, and granted, this is the segment that's incarcerated, but it was ubiquitous how they referred to women in their community.
Well, Bob, you know what?
What?
You should listen to some of the music.
Right.
Really, you'd really be disgusted.
Oh, yeah.
Those aren't people in jail. I mean, these are people, too often, to my mind, people who are imitating inmates and thinking that that's the lifestyle to model yourself after. I think too often you see these young kids. I lack words. I'm so upset. But I think that when my kids turn on the TV and watch these rap videos with the gangster rap and these guys looking like criminals and treating women in a criminal manner,
right,
I think that this is something that if the KKK was producing and putting on the air, you would see black organizations protesting. I don't know why more people aren't protesting. But
Juan Williams,
let me add to this very quickly.
How old are your kids?
There is an ongoing protest right now at Spelman College. It's being supported by Essence Magazine, a magazine directed at black female readers.
Right.
And it's called Take Back the Music. And they are really upset about all this talk
about
hoes
and
bitches and all the rest. They are sick of it, and it's reached the breaking point with them, and I could not admire it more. And that's coming from an historically black college.
Well, that's important, although the black rap and this whole movement has had pretty much 20 years of no resistance. But you said you had kids. How old are your kids?
24, 23, and 16.
Well, congratulations. I was on ABC on Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher a handful of times and debated Cisco, the black rapper.
Mm-hmm.
And he had gone platinum before the show. And I had the lyrics in my pocket that I took out during the show, and he sort of slithered down in his seat like a snake. And the lyrics are things like, here's what you should do to your aunt and leave her in the gutter. Like the most despicable, vulgar, not only foul mouth, but talking about sexual crimes against women, against female relatives, and leave them in the gutter when you're done with them. And And this is happening in the white community also. That's for granted. That's true.
Right.
But it's had an even greater devastating effect on the black community, just like welfare. Welfare has hurt blacks more than whites because the economic threshold to where that kind of subsistence looked appealing. Like if you're making a lot more money than you can get on welfare, you're not attracted to welfare. And since blacks had a lower average per capita income, then welfare looked more appealing. And every tax dollar transferred to black mothers is $1 less they need from a husband. And that's the downside of welfare. It's easier to live with a check than with a man. And so we've seen, partly through white guilt for slavery, we've seen the black family systematically dismantled, and I'm discouraged that black colleges have looked at this superficially, and they haven't helped us, those who are concerned about the moral foundation of the family. They haven't helped us prop the black family back up. They've been an influence to further tear it down.
I don't understand why you say they've been an influence to tear it down, and obviously the historical analysis that you offered, I think, is a bit flawed. My experience is that what you have is people were denied first educational opportunities, as we've been talking about, but then they were denied economic opportunities.
Absolutely.
So you had a very impoverished population, and the effort by the government, at least in its initial phase, was to try to help people out of poverty. And I think regardless of your race, regardless of your faith, I think we all understand that that's in the best interest of America, is that we not have a pool of poor, destitute, and desperate people. Secondly,
well, and Juan, I just think our welfare system, we could demonstrate that it made the poverty even more miserable than it had been, and it's hurt more than it's helped.
I don't know that you can demonstrate that, but I think that you could demonstrate that in many cases, and that's why I said many. I hope you note that word well. I didn't say a few, but in many, there are many cases where you could say, you know what, I see the negative repercussions of people coming to rely on a welfare check. And so, I mean, in the black community, there's so many conversations, and this goes back to, remember, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, when he issued a paper about the problems of the black family, including reliance on welfare and the difficulty in terms of marriage and growth of the number of children being born out of wedlock, he was attacked by sort of black intellectuals who said, oh, you know, why are you criticizing the black family? But nobody said, oh, no, this business about welfare is wrong. People have long viewed that the welfare system, the social workers who come in, were really offering the wrong incentives in terms of trying to hold black couples, husband and wife, together, to hold them together as role models then for children who could then go on to form healthy families. So on all those levels, I think you're on to something, Bob, but you should not. I think you're wrong to somehow say that by giving people the opportunity to escape poverty, America was doing something wrong. I think America was doing something great. And
okay,
it was the same kind of great thing we did for white families.
That'll have to be, though.
The New Deal with Franklin Roosevelt after the Great Depression.
Juan, we're out of time. That'll have to be the last word, and perhaps sometime in the future we could have you on and discuss that very topic.
I'd be delighted, Bob. It's always good to be with you.
Thank you so much. Juan Williams, the author of I'll Find a Way or Make One, a tribute to historically black colleges and universities. If you are interested in history or have attended a black college, I think you'll love the book. It certainly is fascinating and rich with rare photographs and very interesting history. So, hey, Maranatha Christian Center in Arvada, talk about schools. The best Christian school I've ever seen. Their phone number, 431-5653. That's Maranatha Christian Center, 431-5653.